It's the NPR News Update for Thursday, May 9. I'm Phil Picardi. On the podcast, same-sex marriage supporters get their day at the state capitol. Victims of child abuse may get more time to sue. Advocates of Minnesota water projects have an eye on Congress. And kayakers look to shoot the gnarly rapids along the North Shore. First, the Minnesota House voting today on same-sex marriage. Last night, Matt Sepik found supporters at a vigil in St. Paul.
At Christ Lutheran Church near the Capitol, Pastor Anita Hill told the capacity crowd she's hopeful lawmakers will pass the measure so she and others in same-sex relationships may marry in Minnesota.
Tonight, we stand on the edge of hope, of possibility, and we are here to pray a new reality into being.
Those who oppose letting gay couples marry also plan to pray and protest at the Capitol. Autumn Leva of Minnesota for Marriage cites a Star Tribune poll from March that shows 53% of residents oppose same-sex marriage.
And the more telling number is that number goes up to 73% out in greater Minnesota.
If the House passes the bill, a Senate vote could come Monday. Governor Dayton says he'll sign it. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
For many state lawmakers, the same-sex marriage vote carries significant political risk. In Aiken, in north-central Minnesota, a solid majority voted for the constitutional amendment last year that would have banned same-sex marriage. Even so, a first-term representative from the area says he will vote to legalize same-sex marriage. Here's Mark Zedeklik.
At Duane's Barber Styling, a few steps from the main intersection in downtown Aiken, the owner, Duane Gross, says he's heard plenty of talk about DFL Representative Joe Radinovich's decision to vote to legalize same-sex marriage.
Oh, yes, I have.
And as he trims a customer with an electric clipper, Gross is quick to state his opposition to same-sex marriage. He calls it ridiculous that his representative in the Minnesota House is in favor of gay marriage when 63% of Radinovich's constituents voted to ban same-sex marriage by amending the Constitution.
They don't want two men or two women to be married. They're for one man and for one woman. And in democracy, you should be representing the majority, and that's what the majority wants. That's what he should be representing.
The older gentleman getting his hair cut calls same-sex marriage a slap in the face to those in traditional marriages. He also makes it clear he wants the conversation to end.
Hey, you're busting up my haircut here, guy. I don't need an angry barber.
150 miles southeast of Aiken, in an interview on the floor of the Minnesota House, Representative Radinovich says voting against same-sex marriage would betray his conscience and that good public servants need to be true to themselves.
I'd rather have the voters be upset with me right now than for me to be upset with myself for the rest of my life.
Well, it sounds to me like he must be gay, too. I'm totally against that.
That man back in downtown Aiken would not give his name. Before the recorder was rolling, he said gay people should be rounded up and shot. Standing next to him on the sidewalk was Paul Ellingson of Crosby, another one of Radinovich's constituents. Ellingson says he does not oppose same-sex marriage. Still, he thinks representatives need to vote in line with the wishes of the majority of the people they represent.
You know, with anything, you know, the representative is responsible for representing his district and the wants of the people, and if he isn't doing that, then he's dead wrong. I don't care what the issue is.
But not everyone interviewed in downtown Aiken for this report said representatives like Joe Radinovich should be compelled to act on the will of the majority of their constituents. Joan Kingsley was shopping with a friend. She said Radinovich should do what he thinks should be done.
Well, we elected him to do what he thought was best.
But Kingsley also said going against the will of the majority could very well cost Radinovich the chance of being reelected. The notion lawmakers should vote based on what they think is right, not what the majority of the people they represent want done, seems to be the minority opinion in Radinovich's district. And there's already an effort to hold a recall election to replace Radinovich over the same-sex marriage issue. Doug Kern, who lives just south of Brainerd in Radinovich's district, has filed a recall petition and is already collecting signatures.
When you have a representative that is clearly not representing his constituents, absolutely, positively not representing them, that's wrong.
But it's probably not grounds for recalling a lawmaker. The Minnesota Constitution says a recall can only proceed if a public official is convicted of a serious crime or is otherwise deemed guilty of serious malfeasance or nonfeasance. Longtime Aiken County Republican Pat Williams signed Kern's petition, even though he doubts Radinovich will be recalled. He does think that Radinovich will have a hard time getting reelected next year.
It is a strong warning to him and perhaps to others like him that they shouldn't be disregarding what a majority of the people want in terms of their representation.
Radinovich says he's planning to run for re-election and that he's looking forward to discussing his support for same-sex marriage with constituents and that he's at peace with his decision to vote yes.
Mark Zedeklik in Aiken. The Minnesota Senate has passed a minimum wage bill. It raises the rate to $7.75 an hour by 2015, with automatic increases tied to the rate of inflation. Senate Republicans raised concerns about the impact on small businesses. GOP Senator Roger Chamberlain of Lino Lakes.
This isn't a bill to lift people up. This is going to lose jobs, cost jobs. This is a poverty bill. This is another bill of false hope and false promises.
The House passed a bill last week to raise the minimum wage to $9.50 an hour. A conference committee will work out the differences before sending it on to Governor Dayton. Minnesota may soon give victims of child sex abuse more time to sue their abusers. The Child Victims Act would also allow victims to sue schools, churches, or any other group that failed to protect them. Madeline Barron says the bill passed the Senate yesterday.
Victims of child sexual abuse watched from the public gallery above the Senate floor as the votes came in. Joel Juris from Cambridge kept his eyes on the vote tallies.
From the beginning, there was one yes vote and zero nays, and then two, and then 15, and then 20, and then 30, and still zero nays.
The final vote was 66-0. Juris was stunned.
It was like the entire Senate was standing next to me saying, "We understand your plight, we understand your story, and we stand behind you."
Juris came forward last year to tell police about how a boarding school teacher had sexually abused him more than three decades ago, when he was just 14 years old. The vote yesterday caught him off guard.
It was a powerful moment. There were so many positive emotions that I couldn't even cry.
The House passed a similar bill last week. A spokesperson for Governor Mark Dayton says she expects he will sign the bill into law. If that happens, jurists and other Minnesotans who suffered sexual abuse as children would be able to sue their abusers and any institutions that were negligent. Right now, those lawsuits are not allowed after the victim turns 24. Bill author, DFL Senator Ron Latz of St. Louis Park, says the current law is unfair.
We need the courthouse to be open to them when they are able to come forward. Those legally responsible perpetrators and those that protect them can escape justice just because of the passage of time.
The bill gets rid of the civil statutes of limitation for child sexual abuse cases going forward. Older cases would be treated differently. The bill gives those victims 3 years to file lawsuits. The Minnesota Religious Council opposed the change. The group lobbies on behalf of Catholic, Methodist, Lutheran, and Episcopal churches. It's fought off similar efforts since 2003. The group testified earlier this session that allowing victims more time to sue would open up churches to costly lawsuits that would take money away from helping the poor. The council did not respond to an interview request. Yesterday, several lawmakers raised questions about how the law would affect churches and other organizations. Republican Senator Julian Ortman of Chanhassen said the legislature should be careful.
Everyone in this room should be having great concern about authorizing liability for churches, for our schools, for businesses that since the time of these events probably have very questionable evidence available to defend themselves.
In other states that pass similar laws, victims have filed suits that expose negligence by churches and others. St. Paul attorney Jeff Anderson says he expects the same will happen in Minnesota. Anderson has represented hundreds of people who were sexually abused as children. Now, he says, Minnesota victims will get their day in court.
They can bring civil damage claims against the individual that offended them and expose that individual in the community. They can also hold the institutions and the employers that chose to protect the offenders instead of the kids accountable for their negligence and their role in allowing it to happen. which means that the communities can be a safer place.
If the bill is signed into law, Anderson says he will sue institutions he believes covered up or didn't do enough to prevent child sexual abuse. His list includes the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, the Diocese of Winona, the Boy Scouts, and Shattuck St. Mary's Boarding School in Faribault. Back at the Capitol, Juris says he doesn't know whether he'll file a lawsuit.
Right now, at this moment, I just feel empowered. And that may in itself just be enough.
Lawmakers say they'll work out minor differences before sending the bill to the governor's desk.
That's Madeline Barron. The charities that offer pull tabs in Minnesota are planning a statewide blitz next month to try and build interest in new electronic games, so says Tim Nelson.
Allied Charities of Minnesota is planning what it calls a roadshow in 8 Minnesota cities, probably in June. The charities are trying to drum up enthusiasm for the electronic pull tab and bingo games earmarked to help pay the state's share of a new Viking stadium. Al Lund is executive director of Allied Charities.
I think that there's still a lot of charities that haven't really looked at it close enough. I know that a lot of charities have their opinions, but we just think this will be a time that they can come in and actually see the devices, see what they do, talk to charities that have been involved.
The new electronic games have had disappointing results so far. They're bringing in a small fraction of expected gambling taxes and are in less than 10% of the places they were projected to be.
Tim Nelson on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. After a 5-month lockout and a bruising contract battle, the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra resumes concerts this evening. Here's Ewan Kerr.
SPCO concerts resume with just 5 weeks left in the 2012-2013 season. The orchestra will play a program of Mozart, Schumann, and Schoenberg under the baton of artistic partner Thomas Zettmeyer and featuring British cellist Stephen Isserlis. The concerts are part of the SPCO's Neighborhood Series and will be presented tonight at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church in Apple Valley, Friday at Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, and Saturday at St. Paul's United Church of Christ. Anticipating audience demand, an extra concert has been added Friday morning in Eden Prairie. However, limited tickets remain for this weekend's performances. The SPCO season runs through June.
Ewan Kerr there, now Jess Mador with more. On the Met Council's decision to officially amend its transportation policy plan to include light rail for the planned Bottineau Transitway.
Hennepin County had already selected LRT for the project. The action by the Met Council allows the Bottineau rail line to officially advance. The 13-mile line would run between Brooklyn Park and Minneapolis, where it would connect to other light rail and bus lines. The Met Council is also considering adding more bus service in North Minneapolis. The Bottineau light rail line is expected to begin operation within the next 9 years. It would be the Twin Cities' 4th light rail line after the planned Southwest LRT.
That's Jess Mador. A detention hearing has been postponed for a man accused in what the FBI is calling a thwarted terror plot in western Minnesota. But as Martin Moylan reports, Buford Rogers remains in federal custody.
The delay would give Andrew Mooring, Rogers' public defender, more time to investigate the accusations against his client. Mooring said law enforcement officials have released a lot of misinformation about his client, but Mooring would not be specific. Outside a courtroom in the federal court in St. Paul, Mooring said there's nothing he can share and nothing prosecutors and law enforcement officials can either. Judge Jean Graham said she would consider a gag order if it were requested. Rogers is scheduled to make another court appearance on May 17th. The prosecution did not object to delaying the detention hearing. Rogers' father has said his son is not a terrorist.
That's Marty Moylan. The Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota is moving to ban smoking on campus. Alex Friedrich has more on that.
Ferd Schlopper, director of the U's Boynton Health Services, said a recent survey showed 2/3 of the U's students, faculty, and staff were supportive of a ban. He says research shows that the inconvenience of a ban actually helps people stop smoking altogether.
We're trying to make it a little more inconvenient for people to smoke, which is why 25% of our smokers actually support this type of policy, because over half of them are trying to quit 2 to 14 time attempts in the last year, and they recognize that this will help me work toward quitting.
Schlopper says the ban would likely take effect in the next 12 to 18 months. Already 1,200 campuses in the U.S. are smoke-free, including 49 in Minnesota. And at least three other U of M campuses have already banned it.
Alex Friedrich on Higher Ed. Minnesota's export growth slowed in 2012. Here's business reporter Annie Baxter.
The latest report from the Minnesota Trade Office shows that the state's companies exported nearly $21 billion in products last year. That was a record, but the annual pace of growth slowed considerably compared to the year before. Japan lost its ranking as Minnesota's third largest export market, falling down a notch to fourth place. State officials attribute the change to a decrease in corn exports to Japan. Meanwhile, some of the strongest growth last year occurred in sales to Central and South America. Minnesota companies' exports of machinery and medical instruments to Brazil were especially robust.
Annie Baxter on the NPR News Update. The U.S. Senate is debating a bill that would greenlight water projects across the country. They include a massive flood control system in the Fargo-Moorhead area. The bill also could fund a number of other projects in the state. Our Washington-based reporter Brett Neely has more.
While most people get to enjoy the onset of spring, that's a different story on the North Dakota-Minnesota border.
Flood preparations move into high gear this week in Fargo-Moorhead construction.
That was last month. Since then, the Red River is crested at a much lower level than first expected. Still, residents of the area want something more permanent than sandbags to control flooding. Enter the Water Resources Development Act under debate in the Senate. Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar is one of its supporters.
There are many things in this bill that are important to Minnesota.
It would give the go-ahead for the Army Corps of Engineers to begin work on the Red River Diversion Project and scores of other water projects nationwide. The Corps estimates the diversion could significantly reduce major flooding in the Fargo-Moorhead area. North Dakota will pick up more than half of the cost of the project, and the federal government will pay for much of the rest. Unlike most legislation these days, this water bill appears set to sail through the frequently deadlocked Senate. One reason? There's something for everyone in it. Josh Sewell is with the nonprofit group Taxpayers for Common Sense. He says this kind of legislation is more or less filled with earmarks, even though Congress has officially banned that practice.
I think these water bills are one of the last hurdles to get to have the country move beyond earmarks.
The bill authorizes major projects in California and Louisiana, the states that are home to the two Democratic and Republican senators who are leading the charge for the water legislation. Sewell says the Corps of Engineers is routinely over budget and behind schedule. Authorizing more projects could overburden an already stretched agency, Sewell says, and slow the $1.8 billion Fargo-Moorhead project.
But that's basically the minimum it's going to cost. I can guarantee that.
The Senate water bill would also free up money for Duluth to deepen its port. Minnesota's aging locks and dams on the upper Mississippi River could also see money as a result of the legislation. The bill's backers frequently bring up the issue of aging infrastructure. Mike Tuohy is the president of the Waterways Council, the barge industry's trade group.
Lord knows what would happen if a major lock failed and what it would do to our national economy.
The cost of building locks and dams is funded by a tax on barge fuel that hasn't been raised since the 1990s. The money goes into a trust fund, but like many of the transportation trust funds, it's basically broke because of cost overruns and Army Corps construction projects. Tuohy says the industry supports increasing the fuel tax, something he says many members of Congress have trouble understanding.
Well, they certainly react to it with amusement and are sometimes befuddled by this notion that we're willing to pay more.
That proposed tax increase hasn't yet been added to the bill. Klobuchar says even with the industry's support, selling any kind of tax increase is hard in this Congress.
Even when industry is paying for stuff, some of the more conservative Republicans who've signed certain pledges don't like it.
Still, Josh Sewell with Taxpayers for Common Sense says the proposed fuel tax increase would only restore the tax to the level it was 20 years ago, once it's adjusted for inflation. Moreover, the tax money only pays for construction, not maintenance. Sewell says that means the country's waterways would actually maintain a very privileged position relative to other modes of transportation.
The inland waterway system is the most highly subsidized transportation system in America, by far.
The Senate's expected to pass the bill early next week, but it's a different story in the House. The Republican majority there isn't likely to consider this bill before fall at the earliest, so those living along the Red River might have to wait a bit longer for permanent flood control.
Brett Neely on Big Water. Now to close out the podcast, Dan Crocker on wild water. For the next couple of weeks, kayakers are arriving in northeastern Minnesota to try their hand at the raging rivers and creeks along the North Shore flowing into Lake Superior. Dan says it's world-class whitewater kayaking in an out-of-the-way and unexpected place.
Along the North Shore of Lake Superior, streams like the Lester River in Duluth are roaring, full of chocolate-brown, frothy, churning spring runoff. It's that time of year when hikers are warned to stay away from the creeks, and when kayakers like Chris Baer flock to them.
It's phenomenal. It really is great paddling for about a month a year.
Baer is about as close as you can get to a professional kayaker. He's a raft guide for about half the year in Colorado and West Virginia, but spends the other 6 months kayaking around the globe. And he says the whitewater here, at least for a few weeks, is as good as it gets.
When it's all melting, it comes down fast, and that 1,000 feet of gradient from the ambient landmass down into Lake Superior works in our favor, and we get some really cool rapids for a month a year.
Baer calls them rapids, but to most people, this is a waterfall, a 20-foot, nearly vertical, Class 5 plunge into a deep, rocky gorge. Baer shoots the falls smoothly, but gets stuck in a powerful hydraulic at the bottom, where the water recirculates like a giant washing machine, trapping his boat. He has to swim to shore, but determined, he drags his boat up for a second run. This time, he angles his kayak perfectly and slides just past the whirlpool.
Practice. Woo!
All the way up the North Shore, a select group of expert kayakers braves rivers like the Baptism, Cascade, and Devil's Track. The streams are only a few miles long, but they're steep. They come tumbling down hundreds of feet from the ridge that parallels Lake Superior and feature razor-sharp rocks, three-story vertical drops, and frigid water.
I think you have to be of a different character to run the rivers on the North Shore. I'll put it as diplomatically as I can, maybe a little bit crazy as well.
That's John Kiffmeyer, who's paddled the North Shore for nearly two decades and now works for a kayak company in Asheville, North Carolina.
I remember one video where somebody had flipped coming down one of the slides and it had cut the top of his eye so that his eyelid wasn't connected anymore. I mean, it's not without danger. I myself have broken both my ankles going over a waterfall.
But Kiffmeyer says the paddlers who tackle North Shore creeks reach a level of experience where they feel comfortable in water that, to the untrained eye, looks, well, kind of nuts.
There's things that you're doing with your paddle, with your body, with your boat angle, with your core, and you can't see all of that happening, but there's a lot of premeditated action that's going in. That's happening because of instinct. That's happening because you've spent so much time on the water. You know what to do.
Kiffmeyer and a host of other paddlers were introduced to North Shore Creeks by a kayaking legend named Jim Rada. Rada was an astronomy professor and the first person to run several Minnesota creeks. Kiffmeyer says his guidebook, North Woods Whitewater, was like kayaking gospel.
His book was it. I mean, if you wanted to go kayaking, you would do everything to try and find one. And originally, that was very difficult. I've got what's called the Kinko's edition.
Which means Rada literally photocopied the pages and gave them to Kiffmeyer for $20. He says Rada insisted on meeting people first.
Because he felt very personally responsible. He had written these descriptions of the rivers. He guided you to them. And so there was a sense of personal responsibility that he had, that he wanted you to be safe.
Kayaker Anthony Balsiger of Bloomington says that camaraderie continues today.
Everybody's real supportive. It's a high-fiving kind of group. There's no attitudes and there's no egos. I mean, we're all kayakers, so everybody's got a little bit of an ego. You wouldn't be doing it otherwise, but everyone's real cool with each other. Nobody's not willing to help out.
Something Jim Rada would no doubt like to hear. 10 years ago, this spring, Rada died of a heart attack while paddling a river in northern Michigan. His book was finally published soon after and is still essential reading for those with the skill and guts to paddle the raging creeks on the North Shore.
Dan Crocker reporting in Duluth. I'm Phil Picardi here in St. Paul, and you've been listening to the NPR News Update. All the news on the same-sex marriage vote and other Friday stories right here tomorrow.